Now to the name that's been chanted in connection with Iran in streets of cities like Sydney and Melbourne, other parts of the world outside Iran, and on some Iranian streets, Pahlavi. The name of the former Shah, and of course the name of his son, who is now putting himself forward as a potential leader of a post-Ayatollah Iran. But how much support is there inside Iran for the self-styled Shah in exile? And what is the history of his family? Joining us to discuss this is Dr. Roham Alvandi, Associate Professor of International History and Director of the Iranian History Initiative at the London School of Economics. Roham wrote Nixon, Kissinger and the Shah, the United States and Iran in the Cold War. And he's recently written that the unresolved political legacy of Pahlavi rule continues to haunt Iran's opposition. Dr. Alvandi, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, the Pahlavis are referred to often as a dynasty, which creates the impression of ruling over many generations, but there were only two Shahs from that family. Could you tell us when and how they came to power?
Well, Reza Shah, the founder of the Pahlavi dynasty, was a military officer who made a coup in 1921 at a very difficult time for Iran after the First World War, when the country really was in a state of disarray. He made a bloodless coup, came to power, and really began the whole process of building the modern Iranian nation state. He was of that generation of leaders like Mustafa Kemal in Turkey, who really oversaw the transition of Iran from what was a very ancient but decaying empire to what you might call a modern nation state. His son, Mohammad Reza Shah, who came to the throne in 1941 in the midst of the Second World War, continued that project right up until his overthrow in 1979. But the transformation that took place in Iran between 1921 and 1979 was extraordinary. I mean, most of what you see in Iran today, the institutions, the industries, all the elements of the state have their origins and roots in that Pahlavi era.
Okay, well, let's go sort of Shah by Shah, if you like. Reza Shah Pahlavi ruled for 16 years and was obviously seminal in the modernization of Iran. Looking back at his rule, could you give us an overview of his achievements and what also the main criticisms of his period as Shah were?
Reza Shah began this sort of process of what you might call authoritarian modernization in Iran. It's also important to note that he actually didn't want to be Shah. His initial instinct was to create a republic in Iran, modeled very much on Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the modern Turkish Republic. But he was essentially talked out of it by predominantly the clergy in Iran, who were very unhappy with the sort of secularizing potential of a republic and who wanted to preserve the monarchy as a traditional institution and as the sort of defender of the Shia faith. And so he accepted the crown in 1925, but his policies, it really had to do with building the basic institutions of the modern Iranian nation state, beginning with the Iranian army. I mean, Iran had not really had much of a standing army prior to the Pahlavi period. And so he really began, first of all, to build a modern military based on conscription, drawing with, you know, modern military training and techniques. And he essentially used that army to reunify the country, to put down rebellious forces all over the country, to take away the power of nomadic tribes, to essentially take over control of parts of the country that were under British influence. And so he is remembered as a unifier of modern Iran. But of course, you know, unification based on a modern concept of Iranian nationalism also meant homogenizing Iran, flattening the diversity of Iran. And that came with cost, particularly for non-Persian ethnic groups in Iran, such as the Kurds, who have very bad memories of the Pahlavi era. But really, his probably most important legacy was the creation of a modern Iranian middle class. Most of the sort of institutions, the universities, the modern banking system, the government bureaucracies, I mean, all of these were built in Reza Shah's period. The Trans-Iranian Railway that for the first time connected the whole country. All of this encouraged the creation of urban middle class that had existed in, you know, on the margins, really, prior to that, had been a very small group, you know, in Iranian society, but really exploded in size under in the Pahlavi era. And I think the intelligentsia of this modern middle class, the people who experience really dramatic kind of social mobility in this Pahlavi period, rallied to the cause of nation building in Iran. And despite sort of Reza Shah's authoritarianism, shared a sense of patriotism and his vision for an Iran that would try to restore the power that it had once had long before and sort of free the country from the yoke of particularly British and Russian imperial influence.
Reza Shah was succeeded by his son Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in 1941, and he would be the last Shah, as you said, before the Islamic Revolution in 1979. What's your overview of the pros and cons of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi as Shah?
Reza Shah's modernization certainly created enemies for the monarchy. I think the group that he most directly clashed with were the clergy in Iran, the Shia clergy, who were completely opposed to his secularizing policies. The most controversial of those was the forced unveiling of Iranian women. And I think his son, Mohammad Reza Shah, who came to the throne in extremely difficult circumstances. I mean, Iran had been occupied by the Allied powers during the Second World War. Reza Shah had been forced to abdicate and go into exile. His son really inherited a very weak throne with a lot of enemies, particularly amongst the clergy. And so he had to begin, I think, in a very modest way. I mean, in the early years of Mohammad Reza Shah's reign, he was not very dominant or authoritarian ruler. He was something more akin to a kind of constitutional monarch. And the period from 1941, from the abdication of his father all the way up until 1953, when an Anglo-American coup toppled Iran's prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, that period is a kind of liberal period in Iranian history where there were relatively free elections, a free press, but it was also a period of incredible turmoil because these radical religious forces were carrying out assassinations, were violently opposed to the secularizing trends in Iranian society. And then, of course, at the same time, you had the rise of a fairly powerful Iranian left, the creation of the modern Iranian Communist Party, the Tudeh Party, in the 1940s. So, you know, Iran, like all other countries of this period of the 1940s and 1950s, is being influenced by the political winds that are blowing all over the world, radical politics on the right, radical politics on the left. It's the age of extremes, you know. And so you have a fairly weak Iranian state in those first couple of decades. But all of that changes, really, in 1953. You have a nationalist Iranian government that decides to nationalize Iranian oil, take it out of the hands of Britain, led by Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who was essentially a liberal democrat, a constitutionalist. This provokes essentially the biggest crisis of the Shah's reign. He has to decide really whether he's going to be on the side of Iranian nationalism and in opposition to foreign influence and meddling in Iran. But if he does that, it's going to come at the cost of his own power within the country because Mossadegh wants to reduce him to a constitutional monarch. Mossadegh's view is that the Shah should rule but not reign. And essentially in that confrontation in 1953, the Shah emerges triumphant with the help of Britain and the United States, the CIA an MI6 orchestrate a coup in Iran to topple Mossadegh's government. And that completely transforms the nature of the Shah's rule. Mohammad Reza Shah becomes really an authoritarian ruler, very much similar to his father in many ways. But of course, he's dealing with a very different world. By the time you get to the 1960s and 1970s, this is a modern, interconnected, interdependent world. And his place in that, and Iran's place in that, is really of a major oil producer. And so the enormous oil wealth that begins to come into Iran, really starting in the sort of late 1960s into the early 1970s, fuels ambitious kind of modernization project on the Shah's part that really is carrying on the big project of his father, but really on a much, much, much bigger scale.
And I think you've said that women were the primary beneficiaries of that stage of modernization. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, the secularizing policies of the Pahlavi state, combined with the creation of a modern middle class and the enormous social mobility that takes place, the greatest beneficiaries of that are Iranian women. There's clear evidence that on average, Iranian women in the 1960s, 1970s, enter into the workforce, they having fewer children, they're having children later in life. And you can see that they are essentially enjoying a degree of both personal freedom, but also economic independence that they've really never had in Iranian history. But of course, what comes with that is tremendous social upheaval. That kind of change in a society at such rapid speed is also going to generate a backlash, particularly from religious conservatives. So you have at the social level, this kind of dislocation. You have a modernizing Pahlavi state that's secularizing Iranian society, benefiting the sort of urban middle class, but in some ways coming at the expense of the more traditional segments of Iranian society. You have that kind of going on at a social level. And then at the same time, you have an authoritarian state, which at the political level is not creating any mechanisms for unleashing or releasing this kind of political steam that's building up in this society. There's no democratic or legal mechanism for people to be able to debate these kind of issues, resolve them, and the government that's carrying out these modernization policies doesn't have the kind of democratic legitimacy, democratic mandate to be able to carry out what are, you know, really fairly dramatic and in some cases controversial changes in Iranian society. So you start to have a real clash between state and society in Iran, particularly in the 1970s. This pressure starts to build up.
Yeah, which clearly set the stage for an authoritarian counter-revolution in 1979.
Yeah.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. Roham Alvandi, who is the director of the Iranian History Initiative at the London School of Economics. Let's move on to the next generation of Pahlavi, Roham. Reza Pahlavi, the eldest son of the last Shah before the revolution, was named Crown Prince when his father was crowned in 1967. You've said Prince Reza's unwillingness to confront inconvenient truths about his father undermines his repeated professions of support for democracy in Iran. Could you elaborate on that for us, please?
Iranians have not reached any kind of consensus on the Pahlavi period. It's not settled history. For some, it's a history of progress and modernization and really a golden age of Iran. For others, it's a period of dictatorship and torture and political prisoners. And
from what you said, it sounds like it was both.
Yeah, the reality is that both of those things can be true at the same time. But in this age of polarized politics, we don't have that level of nuance. And so Reza Pahlavi, in a sense, inherits all of that as the Shah's heir. The irony is that the Shah himself, in the last years of his reign, when he was ailing from cancer, began a liberalization in the hope that his regime would transition to some kind of constitutional monarchy under his son. He certainly didn't want his son to rule in the same way that he had, but of course that was all cut short by the revolution. In fact, that whole liberalization process, in a way, unraveled his regime and led to the revolution. So Reza Pahlavi finds himself in a situation where he benefits from the positive legacy of the Pahlavi past, but he also wants to ignore the negative legacy of the past and wants to deflect from it, in particular, the history of the 1953 coup and the Shah's role in the overthrow of Mossadegh's government, which really hurt the legitimacy of the monarchy. And he's really muddied the historical waters on 1953 in several public appearances and talks. But I think even more important than that is that there's an inherent contradiction for Reza Pahlavi in saying that he stands for a democratic Iran when he is unwilling to confront the inconvenient history of his father's own authoritarianism and unconstitutional rule. So what I have sort of suggested is that if he wants to give Iranians confidence that he is a genuine democrat, and he's not seeking simply to recreate the authoritarian rule of his father, but really to be a transition, a bridge to something better and different, he has to confront those unsavory aspects of his father's rule. And sadly, we haven't seen that. In fact, we've seen quite the opposite in the way that his supporters have behaved, in the way even some of the people that are closest to Reza Pahlavi, some of his closest advisors, behave towards other members of the opposition, or really anyone who dares to question or criticize the prince. This kind of behavior really undermines any claims to being the embodiment of Iran's, you know, democratic aspirations. It's a very unfortunate situation because I think there is a great deal of sympathy for Reza Pahlavi. There is at least, I would say, 30%, maybe more, of people inside Iran.
I was going to ask you that because I know that the Ayatollahs are not known for their opinion polling, nor were the Shahs, to be fair. But you think that's a reasonable estimate that there's about 30% of the current Iranian population that would be positively inclined towards the Pahlavis?
Well, based on the surveys that have been done by an academic group in Holland, a fairly rigorous survey by the Gamon group, we think that the Pahlavi has around 30% support inside Iran. There's another 30% that, if not sort of strong supporters of Pahlavi, they are either positively inclined or indifferent towards him. There's a kind of sense of, well, there's nobody else, you know, so this is the best bet. And then there's another 30% that strongly opposed to him. I think particularly amongst non-Persian ethnic groups in Iran who worry about the possible Persian kind of chauvinism of the Pahlavi movement. So I think what Reza Pahlavi has to try to do is to try to bridge those differences and to present a vision of himself as the embodiment of an inclusive, pluralistic, tolerant version of Iranian nationalism, a kind of civic nationalism, rather than the more populist, royalist kind of narrative that most of his supporters seem to embrace. It's the difference between the MAGA, you know, version of American politics, or the Reform Party, you know, here in the UK, and more sort of mainstream democratic politics. What's unfortunately happened is that Reza Pahlavi has sort of drifted into this kind of more populist camp. You can see that he also aligns himself very closely with, you know, those kinds of political figures like Donald Trump, like Benjamin Netanyahu, like Nigel Farage. And he hasn't really built any bridges to, I would say, more mainstream political groups, either in the West or indeed in Iran. And so that's created an alienation that I think has really hurt his potential to play this role of the transitional leader.
Reza Pahlavi now describes himself as the leader of the national uprising. His homepage says, over four decades, he's been working towards achieving national glory, freedom, legal and political equality for Iran and Iranians, and a democratic and accountable government. Do you agree with any of that?
I think there is some truth to that. in the sense that on the 14th of February, we saw hundreds of thousands of Iranians come out all across the world in a global day of action. And a lot of them, I would say the overwhelming majority of them, were supporters of Reza Pahlavi. And we're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Munich, in Toronto, in Los Angeles, in other places. The question is really whether this translates into support inside Iran. And as I said, I don't think that he has quite the same level of support in Iran as he does amongst the diaspora outside of Iran. And as I say, I think two things have really hurt him. One is that on the one hand, he's trying to present an image of himself as a democratic figure who's going to lead a transition to a democratic Iran, but he hasn't resolved the legacy of his father's reign, and also he hasn't addressed the behavior of his own supporters towards other Iranians and even other Western journalists who have the sort of temerity to question him or disagree with him. So I think that undermines his democratic credentials. But also, I think his close association with the United States and Israel, who are conducting, you know, a military campaign against Iran on Iranian soil that is killing Iranian civilians, I think that also undermines his credibility inside Iran. So I think that if he had adopted a position where he was more independent of Israel and the United States, and he and his supporters had behaved in a more democratic fashion towards their critics and even towards other Iranians who might have been potential allies, perhaps were not monarchists per se, I think he would have been in a much stronger position now. He's going to have to, I think, make some pretty tough choices, political choices, in terms of what he does now as this war now unfolds in Iran.
Yes, indeed. Finally, Roham, a completely unfair broad question. With your deep knowledge of Iranian history, and in particular relations with the United States, you're watching on the situation now from London. Where do you see this current conflict headed in terms of who rules Iran and how?
I'm very worried about where we're going, because it doesn't appear to me that this air campaign is just about eliminating Iran's nuclear program or its missile capabilities or even regime change. It seems to me that the goal is to degrade the Iranian state to such an extent that Iran can never challenge Israeli or American power in the region again. And what's not clear to me is what is going to be left of Iran for anybody to govern, whether it's the remnants of the Islamic Republic or some future regime. So what I find particularly worrying is the news that the United States has decided to arm Kurdish groups to enter into Iranian territory from Iraq to act as the kind of boots on the ground for this military operation. I think that is extremely dangerous. To try to fuel some kind of civil conflict in Iran, which I know will be at the expense of the Kurds more than anybody else, as much as it has been in Syria and Iraq and other places. This is extremely dangerous. And I fear, really, that what we're going to end up with is an Iran that is in utter turmoil domestically, an Islamic Republic that remains in power, albeit degraded, but still a regime that is wounded and has the ability to take out its vengeance, not on the Americans or the Israelis, but on the Iranian people. I mean, there is an enormous fear, I think, now that a level of oppression and persecution is going to come after the dust settles by a regime that is wounded and feeling deeply insecure. So it's a horrific kind of scenario to imagine. I don't see that any real planning or thought has gone into the day after, you know, the bombing stops. I think really the extent of the strategy seems to be that, well, if we destroy and degrade Iran's ability in the best case, the regime falls, and in the worst case, it might still be in charge, but Iran will never be a problem, essentially, for Israel and the United States again. So it's, you know, it's a very different project to the neoconservative, you know, war in Iraq, for example, in 2003, where there was this idea of, you know, rebuilding Iraq, of exporting American democracy to Iraq, and putting hundreds of thousands of troops into Iraq to do nation building. I don't think Trump is even remotely interested in any of that. It's not a war of nation building. It's a war of kind of nation destruction, really. And so for me, and I think many, many other Iranians around the world are really extremely worried about, you know, what is going to come after the bombing stops.
Dr. Roham Alvandi, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
My pleasure.
And Roham is Associate Professor of International History and Director of the Iranian History Initiative at the London School of Economics.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.